Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
One of the worst sounds on earth, the dentist drill. Getting holes drilled into your teeth is not your only worry, though. What about the price tag? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
What's actually in my fridge right now? Do we have yogurt or not?
Therefore, there's a code to cover that scenario.
That's not it. That's not it at all.
This is working for me. I'm gonna stick with it, baby.
Ooh. Oh, there you go.
So funny.
I am a machine.
Some people go too hard. They say, like, I'm not gonna have any more soda.
You know, you didn't have blood tests to determine
interrupt this task that is probably really important.
When do I determine survival?
If you could survive, when you truly, at the end of that, you feel alive.
On today's show, we're going to drill down to get to the bottom of some important issues. Why are big research institutions not reporting study results? How can doctors ask about domestic violence in a way that matters? And how come your cousin Billy just cannot carry a tune? But the first big mystery we're going to look into starts with the mouth. Open up wide. Ah. What goes on in there, the bacteria, the cavities, gum disease, has a big impact on our overall health. Teeth are part of our body, but they have their own insurance system, and the way they are treated is very different from the rest of medicine. Why is that? Alana Gordon is here now, and Alana, you started your sleuth mission in a building nearby that has a really high concentration of dental offices, right?
That's correct. I would like to think it's a little microcosm of the dental universe.
All right, take us there.
So I counted more than 30 offices in this place, which is like one dentist for every tooth. Some of the practices just focus on kids. There's at least one oral surgeon. Another one only does root canals. There's a cash-only boutique. All right, so there's like three offices on the 11th floor. But when you think about it today, about 200,000 dentists work in the U.S. And unlike their peers in the medical field, dentists mostly operate out of small, independent practices.
Good morning, Coleman and Turner Dental Associates. Claire speaking.
Claire Sperano manages an office on the 7th floor. They take some dental plans, but not all. Sperano spends a lot of time behind the check-in desk, figuring out how it all works for the office and for the people who come in.
Not going to pay to replace the tooth.
That can involve a lot of calls to insurers and some painful conversations with patients who may have new coverage or have changed plans.
The patients come in, they think they have one type of coverage. Half the time they find out things aren't covered that they thought they had.
Seated in the waiting area, across from what seems to be a signature of dental offices, a fish tank with an unusually large goldfish, is Thorn Holder. He's got his fingers crossed he can finally have his mouth fixed.
I'm in a lot of pain. This guy right here, my right premolar, you know, my first premolar right after the canine, you know, there was a root canal there. The enamel has broken off around it, and it's in serious pain.
Holder's a former pro soccer goalkeeper. He went for a while without insurance, had some root canals, but he couldn't afford the crowns, so he never got them. Then he signed up for insurance on his own, but most places didn't take it, so some of his teeth are falling apart. The pain's been psychological, too.
You know, this is my smile. This is what people see. They don't see my body. I got a great body. But to see my smile first, I feel like I can't be misinterpreted. I feel like before somebody hear me speak, they might think that I can't.
Holder now has coverage through his wife's work, so he's feeling hopeful. Again, Sperano.
It's stressful. It's stressful because I'm working with a lot of disappointed people until we finally get educated together on what needs to be done.
Sperano says that stress comes in part because the way dentistry and dental coverage work can be a shock to patients. Because when it comes to regular health insurance, you may have premiums and copays and out-of-pocket costs, but it's generally there for the emergencies. What if you get really sick or are in an accident? That's when you bank on coverage really kicking in. The majority of dental plans work in the opposite way. They cover cleanings, but when you need actual dental work, like fillings, cavities, and crowns, It generally only pays up to a certain amount, and then you're on the hook for the rest.
Dental insurance is really just a dental benefit of $1,000 to $2,000. Some lucky people get $3,000 a year, and there are set limits on everything.
It can also function more like a discount club by giving you reduced rates on services. But why is dental its own thing?
By and large, dentistry is very unique that they even carved out a separate insurance from the rest of the body.
Dr. Andrew Spielman is an associate dean at New York University's School of Dentistry. He says this separation, this difference from medical insurance, goes deep into the history of the field itself.
And that actually go back to the 11th century.
Up until the 1700s, 1800s, dentistry was kind of in the background. Teeth were an anomaly.
Unlike bone, teeth do not regrow and do not fuse. They seem to be inert, almost dead, and therefore nobody really bothered with it. So it was pretty much where medicine gave up on teeth and said, this is something that we don't deal with it.
It became more of a craftsman's trade. Barbers, surgeons, wig makers, even blacksmiths would perform dental work.
You have this group of individuals who pretty much pick up a plier and pull teeth without much training or instruction. So it was really a free-for-all type of thing.
In the 1840s, the first dental school opened in Baltimore. That really signaled a formalization of the profession. For a variety of reasons, including resistance from the medical school, the dental school was separate. Spielman says with that and the opening of many more dental schools after, dentistry has pretty much followed its own course. During World War II, health insurance really took off in the U.S. It became a way for employers to attract workers. Those plans didn't include dental benefits. That started servicing separately in the post-war boom.
Bucky Beaver Space Guard!
It was interesting in the 60s, there also began to be a focus by the manufacturers of toothpaste on getting people to the dentist.
Evelyn Ireland is director of the National Association of Dental Plans. She says during that time, toothpaste companies and dental groups started advertising the importance of oral health.
Fresh, clean, and minty. You'll like it. New iPan and toothpaste.
Some dental groups, mainly on the West Coast, created their own dental plans that, by the 70s, joined in as part of the bargaining deals for employee benefits. But remember, health insurance is about having coverage for the worst-case scenarios. These dental plans focused on covering basic cleanings, fluoride services.
Because the two dental diseases, cavities or caries, and periodontal disease, which is gum disease, are largely preventable.
The idea was to avoid the need for high-cost things like implants and crowns. And as a person's tooth complications got worse, so too did their share of the cost. For the most part, that's the way it's been to this day. Ireland says the industry's focus on prevention is a good thing. She says their data has found that most people aren't maxing out their coverage. But recent research is showing that more and more people with dental benefits are postponing needed care due to cost. Spielman, with NYU, also says dentists never really had an incentive to join the medical model, especially as they watch their doctor peers lose their independence, joining bigger health systems as health insurers gained more power.
I think that it was a self-preservation, keeping sort of dentistry out of the managed care and in keeping them separate so they can still ensure a good living.
Nowadays, finances aside, the mouth has been merging back with the body. Dr. Matthew Messina is with the American Dental Association and has a private practice in Cleveland.
You know, I've been practicing for nearly 30 years now, and a tooth has never walked into my office by itself. It's always attached to somebody.
Messina says the field is realizing that the traditional oral health approach may need some rethinking because of the mouth's role in a person's overall health. That includes more communication with doctors and looking out for other health issues that manifest in the mouth, like diabetes and heart disease.
You know, the dentist can be the first person to see so many problems, so we're trying to put it back together. But traditionally, it's the fact that physicians and dentists were trained in separate schools that sort of divided the process.
The isolation of dentists is starting to change. Some dental programs cross-train with nursing and other specialties as part of their education. Inside some community health centers, dentists are practicing side-by-side with doctors. And it's becoming more integrated into some children's health initiatives. All of this has led to a movement toward considering dental benefits as part of standard health coverage. But even though medicine and dentistry are moving closer together in some ways, Messina, for his part, doesn't think how dental coverage works is likely to change anytime soon. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Alana Gordon learned some amazing facts about dentistry in her reporting. For example, that George Washington's dentures weighed 3 pounds. And she also found out why toothaches are so, so painful. We collected all of that great information for you on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Now, something I've always wondered about is how dentists proceed to make conversation with you when you're in the chair, when they know that you can't answer. I asked 2 dentists about this, Derek Turner of Philadelphia and Bakir Jaffrey of South Jersey, and they were both well aware of how weird this can get.
What I do personally is I jam as many instruments and cotton rolls, and I prop their mouth open, and then I try to have a conversation.
You know, saying, how's school going, and you have cotton in your mouth and a mirror and a sharp instrument, that I make a conscious decision not to do.
I just have them speak in vowels. If their mouth is open, the only thing they can sound out is like ah, e, oo, e. And it just sounds like a kind of weird dialogue.
I got a lot of gifts that I like.
I'll just talk to my assistant.
If you're talking to your assistant about the weather or talking about anything else, I wonder how many patients feel that you're not really focusing on exactly what you're doing at that time.
I'll make small talk with the patient where it's, you know, they can nod their head, yes, no, shrug their shoulders.
I do have a couple of patients that say, Dr. Turner, you don't even have to tell me what's going on. Just do what you have to do and let me, you know, the sooner they can get out, the better.
I'll sing for the patients. I love Johnny Cash. I love Tom Waits. I'll sing the national anthem. Anything to make them smile. You put your fingers in other
people's mouths all day. 30 more seconds. I'm almost done. About 2 minutes more of drilling.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. In 2004, drug maker GlaxoSmithKline was sued in a case that involved their antidepressant Paxil, teens, and increased suicide risk. I'm sure you remember the many news stories. Here's one example from ABC, which was filed right after the case was settled.
When Ryan York was 14, he suffered a severe panic attack. Doctors prescribed the antidepressant Paxil. Ryan's condition got worse.
I didn't care about school, family, friends. I didn't care what happened to me.
A year later, Ryan attempted suicide. New York State argued that GlaxoSmithKline failed to warn doctors and the public that some studies showed Paxil did not work in adolescents and might lead to suicidal thoughts.
The high-profile case helped push along legislation that went into effect in 2008. It requires research institutions and pharma companies to report study results from human testing of drugs and medical devices through a website, clinicaltrials.gov. The problem is, seems like nobody is following this law. Joining us now is reporter Charles Piller. He's just published an in-depth investigative report on this issue in STAT. It's a journalism startup covering life sciences. Charles, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
This law, this requirement to report findings was passed because there were growing concerns that pharma companies were perhaps hiding negative results. So this is very important to patient safety, right?
It is. It's important to patient safety and also for doctors and researchers to understand the efficacy of different experimental drugs and also drugs on the market, because sometimes new information emerges that changes the way in which doctors and patients use these medications. I found in my research an interesting example of a nonprofit cancer research network in Indiana that was studying a drug called Avastin, which is a cancer drug. They were using it for patients who had advanced breast cancer. And the drug worked so poorly, it caused so many terrible side effects and had so little benefit to the patients that they were forced to stop the trial even before its completion. But the results, which were required to be posted to clinicaltrials.gov, were withheld for years. And so what you had is a situation where other patients who have cancer, breast cancer, and might have benefited from the knowledge that this new drug that they were testing was not beneficial to breast cancer patients, were deprived of the benefits of understanding what happened in that study, the terrible effects that this had on breast cancer patients for years.
Now, how did you get onto this topic?
Well, it's been known for a long time that reporting has been somewhat lackluster. And what I'm referring to is reporting results to the required government database, clinicaltrials.gov. And what has never been done before our investigation is a close look at what each individual institution is doing in regard to their reporting of results for clinical studies. And what we found is that the leading academic institutions, by and large, did a lot worse even then pharma companies in delivering results in a timely way, as they're required to do by law and, as you pointed out, for patient safety and to help people understand how well these drugs are working.
How badly are we talking about?
Well, I think we can say clearly that no major research organization did well. Only two out of the 98 that we looked very closely at reported their results within the legal guideline of 1 year after the study was completed or terminated, at least 50% or more of the time. This is a pretty shocking and abysmal record for these research organizations, which pride themselves really on being open about their research. What we found was that due to a variety of reasons that a range of investigators told us, they just didn't prioritize the legal responsibility to report results to clinicaltrials.gov. We found this to be hard to understand because even though there is some effort involved, the public benefit to reporting these results and making their information available to other researchers, to patients and doctors, is really quite great. And we found that some would say, well, we just don't have the time. We just didn't think it was a priority, and so they didn't do it.
But did they publish the results elsewhere?
So some of the studies involved publication of results in medical journals, and the researchers argue that this should constitute a full and complete public responsibility to make these results available to the research community and to patients. There are several reasons why that reasoning is not just flawed, but I think socially irresponsible. And here are a few. Often, the research results published in journals come years after the studies were completed because of the extremely long time lag that these studies often face in getting into journals. Second, a lot of those articles are not available to the public without paying a large fee, and consequently, many people don't really have access to them. And finally, and I think perhaps most importantly, is that it's well known that journals often publish results that are kind of cherry-picked by the researcher. So what I mean is that often researchers will shift away from the outcome measures designated at the start of a clinical study to results selected at the study's conclusion. And this can be very misleading because it can imply strong results for a secondary measure that really was not a big part of the idea behind the study. These scientifically less defensible results are then often taken as the important results, and that can be very misleading to doctors and patients.
Charles, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Charles Piller just published an in-depth investigative piece on trial outcome reporting in STAT. That's a journalism startup covering health and science. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Sometimes getting to the root of an issue means you have to ask uncomfortable questions. Doctors are certainly used to that. They ask us about all kinds of very private things. Sex, drugs, how much booze we drink, how much we weigh. But chances are your doctor also asked you something like this during a recent visit.
Do you feel safe at home?
How is your relationship? Or tell me about how your relationship is.
Do you have any concerns about being safe in your home?
Do you feel safe at home?
Do you feel safe at home? That can feel like a strange question to be asked when you've come in for chest pain or because you've cut your finger. But doctors are supposed to ask, because this visit could be a brief window of opportunity to connect a victim to resources. Domestic violence has a major impact on people's health.
Heightened risk for everything from heart disease to asthma to mood disorders. And this is lifelong prevalence for people who are victims.
Marcella Slick heads an initiative at Lutheran Settlement House in Philadelphia, which places domestic violence counselors directly into hospitals. A lot of doctors agree that this is a really important topic to bring up, but it can get pretty daunting.
How do you do that in a timely fashion and do it in a way that's actually kind of sensitive and doesn't seem like it's just a part of a script? How do you do it and then have something to refer them to? Like, all those things, we're really still kind of struggling.
That's Whitney Cabey. She is an emergency room physician and currently on a Robert Wood Johnson fellowship researching the role of social services in an ER setting. Like many of her colleagues, she's still getting used to digging into this complex issue of domestic violence. Anna Morgan is a primary care provider in a clinic that serves mostly Mexican immigrants. She says there are so many issues to be addressed in such a short amount of time.
I don't screen nearly to the level that I would like in an ideal world. And I'm sure that I have missed many patients who have been in violent situations because I didn't ask. And there's a limited amount of time, and oftentimes the patients who we're seeing are very, very chronically ill.
Having domestic violence broadly recognized as a public health issue is a fairly new concept. The Institute of Medicine recommended screening for women in 2011, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services followed suit. Since then, doctors have been refining their techniques on delving into this issue. Sincerity is important.
I think when you read off a script or you're looking at a computer and you're like reading off the thing off the computer screen, I can definitely tell patients are like, what the heck is he doing?
Krista Chayachadi is a primary care provider at the Philadelphia VA. He usually asks about domestic violence in the middle of a visit, so some trust has been established, but the patient's eyes haven't glazed over yet.
I think the other thing is also the volume of questions that you're asking. So that's the complexity of universal screening. I have universal screening for like 6 to 10 different things, given the patient demographic. And oftentimes it's like this litany of like different questions about like their depression, about their domestic violence, about their homelessness, about their medication adherence. And these are all critically important questions. It just, like, you can tell the patient's like, why are you asking me this battery of questions?
Chayachadi doesn't ask every patient about domestic violence. He looks for red flags, such as bruises or black eyes. And he told me he also relies on his gut instinct, and he looks for clues that something is wrong. In the fast-paced ER environment, Whitney Cabey often focuses on her high-risk patients.
My teens, my pregnant moms, women that I can see have been in the ED multiple times for what seem like kind of injuries or physically related, you know, people whose story who may not kind of make sense with the injuries that they're saying that they have.
And then there's another big issue. What happens if you ask and the patient says yes?
yes, there is violence in my home and I don't feel safe.
It can turn a 20-minute visit into a 2-hour visit.
Sometimes I do these screenings and one, I either don't get follow-up on it, so I don't know what happened to this referral that I've done. And a lot of the times these patients, I lose them.
When physicians don't have immediate follow-up available for patients who are victims of domestic violence, if they might be sending them back into a dangerous situation with the suggestion to call a social worker, is it even worth asking? Here's Marcella Slick from Lutheran Settlement House.
With the really small time that health professionals have with their patients, they don't want to necessarily uncover a giant can of worms that they don't have time to deal with.
She says screenings are much more effective when a hospital has a domestic violence counselor on site, right there, something more hospitals are making available. Marcella Slick says many victims will deny being abused in the first place because of fear and shame. But she says just asking the question plants a little seed in their mind that the abuse is wrong, that there's a way out, and that hospitals and doctor's offices are safe places where they can turn. Listening to The Pulse, I'm Mike and Scott. All right, we're going to continue to dig deep, but we're changing topics completely. I'm sure you've been to a birthday party at some point when this happened.
Happy birthday to you.
Birthday.
More.
Singing so off-key, it just might make your ears bleed. Are these people tone deaf? There is some new research on that topic. Joining us now is Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire, also known as Sci Curious. She's a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Hi, Bethany.
Hi.
What are researchers learning about tone deafness?
Well, it's really interesting. First of all, I think a lot of people don't realize that tone deafness is really pretty rare. Every time I run into someone who says, oh, I totally can't sing, I'm totally tone deaf. Most of the time, no, you're not. You just can't sing, which, I mean, I'm sorry. But real tone deafness, real actual hardcore cannot tell one note from another, can't carry a tune in a bucket, that only really afflicts about 1 out of every 25 people. So that's about 4% of people in general. So it's relatively rare. But what's really interesting is that true tone deafness, congenital amusia, they used to think, well, if you can't hear music, there must be something wrong with your ear, right? Mm-hmm. It must be your ear. It's not your ear. People with tone deafness hear just fine. The insides of their ears respond to pitch just fine. So this group of scientists started to look at the brain of these people and say, okay, well, if it's not the ear, maybe it's the primary auditory cortex, the first place where the notes kind of hit the brain on their way in.
Where is that located?
It's kind of actually inside near your ears.
That makes sense.
Yeah. If you kind of poke both hands towards your ears and then you kind of like drill in, you'll hit the auditory cortex. It's in an area called the temporal lobe, which is this little lobe that kind of sticks out on the sides of the brain. It looks like little fingers sticking out on the sides, and it's located there.
Okay, so what did they find when they examined that region in the brain?
So that's what's really interesting. They found nothing.
Hmm.
People with congenital amusia, people who are totally tone deaf, hear notes just fine, both in their ears and in their auditory cortex. As far as you could tell from looking at those two areas, they aren't tone deaf.
So that means we just don't know anything?
Well, no. It's actually a really important thing to know because that tells you where you can start looking next. Because the primary auditory cortex is not, like, that's not where sound ends in your brain. Sound is processed at much higher levels all over the brain in many different areas. And so this tells you, okay, well, it's not the ears and it's not the primary auditory cortex. It's probably in higher centers. It's probably in areas of the brain where these the sounds, the pitches, and their relationship to each other are processed and put together into a tune.
And why do scientists do this? Is there a goal to cure tone deafness? Is the goal just to understand how this happens?
Well, it actually might be interesting to see if you could cure tone deafness. It might help people with congenital amusia actually experience music. I was talking to a commenter for this piece, Adam Greenberg. He's at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And he said people get diagnosed with congenital amusia because they come in and they tell people, I just don't like music. Like, they don't like it. It's not, I don't like country or I don't like classical. They don't like music. And they don't understand why other people listen to it. And, you know, when you think about it, music is everywhere around us. You know, a really good viral cat video is only good if there's music. And so it really, when you think about all the music that's present in your daily life, you can see how if the world suddenly stopped being musical, it might really impact your experience. But it's also important to just understand in general how the brain works and how the brain processes different kinds of sound. You know, what's the difference between speech and music? What's the difference between just a random loud noise and a noise that has pitches that are different? You know, these are important things that we still don't know the answers to.
So what do you think researchers will do next now that they have searched in a place, nothing turned up? Where do you go from there?
Well, now you look higher. So when we talk about higher, we mean centers for higher processing in the brain, which are often toward the front of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, to try and see where people with tone deafness kind of drop the melody.
So the mystery continues, Bethany.
Yes, but we do know that it's going to be somewhere in the brain. The only question is where.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab. Last time you found yourself gazing up at the stars, did you think, this is nice, so quiet and relaxing? But that peacefulness, I don't want to shatter it for you, but space is really not all that tranquil. From the steady beat of a pulsar to the electromagnetic waves of Saturn, the universe is clearly trying to tell us something. The newest noisemaker is something called a fast radio burst, and astronomers say it could provide clues for solving some deep space mysteries. Todd Bookman explains.
All right, listen close, because it's only a fraction of a second long. That's real time. Let's play it again, slowed down. That is a fast radio burst, and the man who discovered it is Duncan Lorimer. He's a West Virginia University professor. Back in 2007, he and a graduate student were sifting through some data collected by a huge radio telescope in Australia, the Parkes Telescope, 210 feet wide, famously located in the middle of a sheep paddock. Anyways, they were looking at all the routine signals that come from our own galaxy when they came across this strange blip, this spike in the radio waves.
It had very different properties to what we were expecting. It appeared to be much, much further away. So we were completely flabbergasted. It was very surprising. We just didn't know what to make of it.
Neither did the scientific community. It was the first time anything like this had been captured. People started referring to it as the Lorimer burst.
Well, you know, it's a nice thing to have. It's not, personally, it's not that important in the grand scheme of things, but it's a nice thing to tell your grandchildren about, I suppose.
Nice, yes, but without a second one on record, there were lots of doubts about what actually caused it. Maybe it was just some radio static or interference or a glitch in the software. 4 years went by, a very nerve-wracking 4 years for Lorimer, before anything similar to his burst appeared again in the sky. But then it happened. Parkes telescope grabbed another one, and then, crucially, a different telescope, this one in Puerto Rico, spotted a burst. It was clear this wasn't a fluke. With only a few on record, though, it's tough to study them. Radio telescopes, despite their massive size, aim a fairly narrow beam at the sky. Some describe it as tunnel vision. And so it takes a while for a burst to pass through the sweet spot. Today, there's only about 10 on record, but scientists think there could be as many as 10,000 of them whizzing toward Earth every day, with some coming from very far away. At least, that's what their signal is suggesting.
And what we can see is that the waves arrive earliest at the telescope at the highest frequencies, and they sort of whistle across our telescope's range of frequencies. It's like a sort of a chirp.
The telescope, to be clear, doesn't actually hear a chirp. We've converted it into a wavelength that the human ear can detect. That scale, the high to low we hear, is caused by the different frequencies arriving at different times. They all start out together in space, but the lower frequencies get slowed down by the electrons they encounter on their long journey to Earth, sort of like hitting traffic. The time in between the highs and the lows, the short delay, allows astronomers to estimate the distance traveled. Lorimer says his burst may have gone 1 billion light years. 1 billion light years. I mean, it sounds like a Hollywood script.
2, 3, 5, 7. Those are all prime numbers. And there's no way that's a natural phenomenon.
Professor, do you know that movie from the late 90s with Jodie Foster?
Are you talking about Contact? Yeah. Yeah, I know it.
What do you think of it?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, it's a great movie. I used to work at the Arecibo Observatory where that was filmed. So it brings back a lot of memories every time I see it.
Who would you want to play you in the sequel?
I wouldn't mind a crack at it myself.
There may not be a Contact 2 on the horizon, but if you've seen the first, you may remember that the source of those radio transmissions is, well, it's aliens.
That is that has been discussed quite a bit because it's a single pulse, a single event. You could actually imagine an extraterrestrial civilization producing this either by accidentally or on purpose, you know, for instance, during one of their nuclear wars or something.
Alien nuclear war as the source? Well, probably not. Lorimer puts that pretty low on the list of possibilities. But at this point, nothing is ruled out. More likely origins are things like blitzars, which is a neutron star that, as it collapses into a black hole, sends out a flash of energy. Or it could be a flare sent off by a magnetar. They're spinning stars with a really strong magnetic field.
Something more exotic is the evaporation of a black hole formed in the early universe due to Hawking radiation that was very famously proposed by Stephen Hawking about 30 years ago. So that's, again, there would be an associated radio pulse with the final death throes of a black hole. The list goes on.
At this point, there are more theories than recorded bursts. While astronomers may not yet have a definitive source, they still see huge potential in what they could learn. Keith Bannister is a researcher based in Sydney, Australia, about 5 hours' drive from the telescope that has collected so many of these pulses. We connected over a fuzzy Skype line.
The organization I work for was responsible for inventing Wi-Fi largely, and the Wi-Fi in our place is hopeless, so, you know, it doesn't win you much.
Bannister says that the data for each burst doesn't just provide an indication of how far it traveled, but also the road it took to get here.
When we detect one of these bursts, it carries with it a very distinctive signature that we can measure very accurately, and that signature, it tells you how much gas that the burst has gone through. They get that signature imprinted on them. Then if we find enough of them, we can actually essentially weigh how much gas there is in that part of the universe, which is a measurement that hasn't ever been possible before.
With that measurement, scientists could nail down what's in between galaxies. Or, Duncan Lorimer says, maybe learn more about the magnetic field of the universe. Really big picture stuff.
They're not going to solve any of mankind's problems right here on Earth. And you probably already knew that. But for astronomers, they're very interesting if we can figure out what they are and how far away they are.
Even with more radio telescopes looking for bursts, Lorimer says it may take 3 to 5 years to answer those questions. Unless the signal is coming from aliens, they may stop by even sooner. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Pittsburgh has some of the worst air pollution of any American city. And now volunteers on bicycles, you know, the people who are usually breathing in all of that bad air, they are helping to track air quality throughout the city. An organization called GASP, Group Against Smog and Pollution, is outfitting their bikes with air quality monitors. Lou Bluen reports.
Sometimes in the field of citizen science, scientific instruments can start to look a little like that science fair project you did back in sixth grade.
Yeah, this is Home Depot, creativity night gone wild.
That's GASP's Jamin Bogie. And yeah, the air quality monitors he's been handing out to volunteers have a definite DIY flair. At first glance, you see some PVC pipes, some zip ties, all held together with a little rubber cement.
And we created a little bracket that should fit on pretty much any bicycle with some Velcro.
Woo! Gotta love the sound of Velcro. More important, though, is what that Velcro is holding on. Hidden inside that DIY mount is an air quality sensor. And that is actually pretty high-tech.
They have a laser inside that shoots around and bounces off of particulate matter. And then it counts the number of particles in the air.
So for the last couple of years, GASP has been giving these monitors out to cyclists. They mount them to their handlebars, and then basically people just ride their bikes all over the city the way they normally would. Except that out on those handlebars, those lasers are taking an air sample once every 10 seconds.
And then we take all that data and put it on a map, color-coded, and in the end, someone on a bicycle or walking or jogging can get a quick glimpse of where might have less pollution, where might have more pollution in a city, and they can make choices based on that data.
An online map that helps people plan less polluted exercise routes is just one of the payoffs of the project. GASP recently did a more targeted ride to try to get a handle on just how much of the city's air pollution comes from vehicles, as opposed to factories and power plants. For this, they had to get a little creative, so they took advantage of an event in Pittsburgh called Open Streets. During this event, several major roads were opened up to bikes, street yoga, and just about anything but cars.
So we had volunteers put our monitors on their bikes and go up and down the route twice. They did that during an Open Streets event, and they did it on another day when traffic was back to normal.
And the result? GASP's monitors found pollution levels were about 4 times higher with cars than without. And this kind of street-level data from specific sites can have big implications as the city plans new infrastructure. For example, Bogie says they're seeing that having protected bike lanes that separate bikes from cars by just a few feet, or planting tree buffers between bike trails and nearby highways, those things can significantly reduce your pollution exposure. GASP hopes the data they're collecting can help justify projects like that. For now, it's more rides and more data, and hopefully unveiling a version 2.0 of their monitor that relies on a little less Velcro. Okay, maybe keep the Velcro. For The Pulse, I'm Lou Bluen.
Lou Bluen is a reporter for the Allegheny Front, a public radio program that covers environmental issues. Listening to The Pulse, I'm Mike and Scott. When Michael Knight was a medical intern a few years ago, he had to work through the holidays for the very first time. During his shift, one patient taught him a valuable lesson about family. Knight told this story for the American College of Physicians Dr. Story Slam.
The sweet aroma of gingerbread wafted through the doorway as I rushed through the hospital hallways to see my patient. It was Christmas Eve. And while everyone else was wondering about Rudolph's shiny nose, I was barely keeping my head above water. I rustled my papers together and rushed to my first patient room. It was Mrs. J. She was laying there covered in a crimson blanket, quietly resting. "Good morning, Mrs. J," I said. "It's Dr. Knight, here to check up on you." She smiled and gave me her warm greeting. There she lay, fighting stage 4 stomach cancer. And after multiple rounds of chemo, there was nothing else that we could offer her medically. Unlike many of my patients, she had been admitted for the majority of the year. In fact, this last admission was going on its 9th week. And through the complications and infections, her spirit continued to soar, and she was always the first patient that I saw every morning. On this morning, I reminded her that tomorrow was Christmas, and I asked her if she was going to have any visitors come to see her. "Oh, yes," she replied. "My entire family will be here. Make sure that you stop by to say hello." I promised her that I would, gave her hand a squeeze, and rushed off to see my next patients. Later that day, I saw Mrs. J being rolled off to chest x-ray. She had spiked a fever and had developed a productive cough. When she was passing, she saw me and she said, "I'll see you tomorrow." It was now Christmas morning, and true to my custom, I started off my day, starting with Mrs. J's room. And "Merry Christmas," she greeted me as I came in the door. I asked her if she was ready to see her family today, and she nodded and motioned to a pile of handwritten cards that she had prepared. I again promised her that I would come back later that evening. As I walked out of the room, I thought about my own family that I would not see this holiday. Now, by that afternoon, my mood was far from merry, and there were a few people that I could have imagined joining those chestnuts and being roasted over an open fire. But I kept my promise, and I made my way to Mrs. J's room. As I was getting closer, I heard the sound of laughter, and I could just imagine her grandchildren pulling at her blanket, or maybe her children recalling stories from days past. But when I entered the room, I was surprised to see the white uniforms of the nursing staff, all smiles surrounding Mrs. J. I made my way to her bedside, and I asked her if her family was still on the way. She replied, "Oh no, they're all here now. I was just waiting on my grandson to arrive." She pressed a small gift into my hand and said, "Thank you." In that moment, we were Miss J's family. We were her foundation, her constant through her prolonged course. And a flurry of emotions ran through my mind. Should I be sad for my patient, upset that her biological family had not shown up, or sorry that these four walls had been her reality for the majority of the past year? But no, I felt honored, honored that on today, not only could I be her physician, but I could be her family. A few weeks later, Mrs. J passed away, and I quietly mourned my patient. But that small gift, a pen, has always remained as a reminder of why I do this thing called doctoring, where you can lend your mind, your time, and your care, and ever so often, you can even lend your heart. Thank you.
Michael Knight is an internist at the University of Pennsylvania. He told this story for the American College of Physicians Doctor Story Slam. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer. Joel Patterson is the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.